Welcome to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. It's time for the final chapter of the Rucka Debrief 07. In this final chapter, we'll take a tour of Greg Rucka's favorite pop culture references, which range from the masters of espionage fiction to Rick and AJ in Simon and Simon. Greg also teases more info about his upcoming Batman-Superman arc. He gives insight into the characters of Tara Chase from Queen and Country, Sacha Bordeaux in Checkmate, and Renee Montoya, The New Question. Greg also has final thoughts on the 52 Project as the last issue hits the stores today. Word Balloon is brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. They've got new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet, they're going to make you glad you made the switch to mail-order comics for all your comic book collecting needs. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% or more, twice as many DC Image and Marvel Monthly specials. For all the details, go to mailordercomics.com. Without further ado, let's pick up with the final chapter of the Rucka Debrief, featuring questions asked by Greg's fans at comicblog.com's forums. Danny asks, does Greg Rucka's comic book writer sell more Greg Rucka novels, or does Greg Rucka novelist sell more of Greg Rucka's comics?
I think, I have no empirical evidence, but I think I have more comics readers who pick up the novels than novel readers who pick up the comics. I suspect that's because comic readers are, for the most part, very, very literate, right? They already know how to read.
Mm-hmm.
For lack of a better way to put it, they're already reading a different language anyway. And, you know, they're not dealing... they're reading comics. What stigma, you know? They've already been stigmatized. Novel readers... You know, it's one of the things that we have to remind ourselves in the industry. There are people out there who don't know where you can find a comic book.
Sure.
And there are novel readers by that token who go, Queen and Country comic, what? I have never been in a mystery bookstore that was selling both the Q&C comics and the novels. They'll have the novels, they won't have the comics. And I don't think that's because the people who are running these bookstores go, well, it's comics. I think it's because they go, it's what?
Yeah, they have no idea.
It's a what? Where would I get it? You know?
Are you being invited to book expos to do both now?
I get invited to attend mystery cons.
Mm-hmm.
But I am... you know, I mean, I'm a reasonably popular writer, but I'm not, you know, on the level of, say, a Brad Meltzer by any stretch of the imagination.
Okay.
And the book industry right now is pretty much one big gaping hemorrhage. And they're all looking for, you know, every publisher wants a book that they don't have to put any promotion into that's going to sell, you know, 100 million copies. So I don't tend to do a whole lot of pub on that sense. I'm going to be at BoucherCon in Anchorage this year, and I'm going to be at BoucherCon in Baltimore next year. I may do Thriller Fest, which is in Manhattan in July.
Okay.
There are a couple other strictly book-related appearances. But, you know, I did this thing in Bristol last year. It was Left Coast Crime in Bristol.
Oh, that's
no
cool.
Figure.
Wow.
And, you know, nobody there. I remember, you know, it was where I met Alan Guthrie, who we were talking about earlier. And we were, you know, I said, you know, I'm in comics. There was one guy there who knew comics.
Wow.
Who, and if he ever hears this, will probably vomit at what I'm going to say next, because I suspect he will hate it. But boy, did he remind me of me when I first came in. You know, when I did my first con, and I had, like, my second or third novel out, and I was a young buck, you know, and it really was that. So I'm the young Turk. I'm going to fuck you guys up. And it was like, yeah, I've been there, done that. But he was the one guy who, you know, was comic savvy. Yeah, and none of the fans were.
Wow.
Most of the fans who go to mystery conventions are in their 40s or up. And there are a lot more women than men.
Okay.
that the comics demographic?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Danny Perkins back. Do you think that Queen and Country would have gotten more attention or sell more copies if it was published by a larger publisher, published in color, or featured American CIA agents rather than the British SIS?
I think it would have a larger readership if it was published by... Maybe it would have a larger readership published by, DC or Marvel. But
just from sheer distribution, really.
Yeah. Certainly would have a larger readership if in color, because there are stores out there that simply will not, stock books that aren't in color.
Crazy.
I think that's insanity, but, I don't run those stores. I don't think the fact that it's SIS makes it particularly obtuse. I don't think it makes it impenetrable. I don't know, honestly. I think now, talking to you in 2007, it probably would if we were doing a story about the CIA now that we're post 9/11 and in this global war on terror. I think that there would probably be an appeal for an American audience there. But that was never an option for me. It was never an option. The inspiration material was always British. And seeing Macintosh's sandbaggers, and I've never made any bones about that.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, that's where my Anglophilia shows. That's how I came to espionage. I came to espionage Bond to Le Carre. Do you see any Americans here so far? to Dayton, again, looking for an American. To Follett, still looking for an American,
Did Mission Impossible and Man from U.N.C.L.E. just not, click with you, obviously?
I didn't find them until much later.
Okay.
And...
Yeah, it's true. You're not as old as...
Yeah, I mean, I remember when FX first started broadcasting, was it FX, and they would show Mission Impossible
yes.
all the time. And I was watching those and loving them, those first season ones, in particular. But Man from U.N.C.L.E., I think if I've seen more than four episodes of that series in my life, I don't think I've seen more than four. And I wasn't that interested in the camp aspects.
It did get silly after a couple of years. It absolutely did.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the thing that, it's like saying was Get Smart, the inspiration. And the answer is hell no.
Great show, though.
Yeah, and it works because of all the other stuff built around it. But,
How about I Spy? There was an intro.
I Spy is, and that one I did see.
Okay.
But again... Not quite the same thing.
No?
Because it was still a little... There was a little more levity in it. And the thing... This is, every writer has a formative... we have our formative posts. We look at stories or movies or shows or even songs or whatnot that we hit, and those were the inspiration. That those some... On some level, sunk into the psyche and impacted. And for me... I found the sandbaggers, after I'd come to know Bond very well, after I'd come to know Le Carre, and then I hit the sandbaggers, and it was the perfect marriage to me. It was the perfect marriage. It was looking at a story that had action and excitement, that wasn't plotting in its pacing, that wasn't impenetrable, but at the same time really took the world it was in and that realism, to task. It had to fit in these rules. And it was the first time I had ever seen espionage as a tool of politics, which is, of course, what it always has been. That's why we have it. If wars are political battles... paid for in blood, then espionage is another tool in that fight. But it wasn't until I hit the sandbaggers, and this is post-Le Carre, It wasn't until I hit the sandbaggers where I saw the political reality as it influenced the intelligence decisions. And that was a revelation for me. And even Le Carré didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the early work, or Tinker Taylor, or Smiley's people, or Honorable Schoolboy, there is really no world outside of the circus.
Right.
In those stories. There really is no question of what's going on in the cabinet level. What's going on with regards to how this might influence trade, or, you know, literally the price of tea in China, you know? And that was, I think, the thing that threw it for me. That was the moment when I was like, hey, politics can be exciting.
Esco from Connecticut, first guest, and I only bring it up because you mentioned it again in your live journal, how the new Atticus book is coming.
Yes.
And I saw that you had just read the first galley, am I correct?
Yeah, actually we did the final proofs. So the proof pages are in, and I received today the cover mock, which I will probably end up posting both on gregrecca.com and on the Live Journal. And according to the letter from my editor, which I will read right now to you, dated the 26th of March, which gives you an idea of how long it took this to get to me, I'm very pleased to enclose an early cover proof for Bantam's August 28th Pub of Patriot Acts. Hope all is well with you and yours. And it is a pretty little cover of red and white stripes, evocative certainly of an American flag, with a smoking bullet hole through the O in Patriot.
Nice.
So there you go.
Was there a certain woman that inspired you to write Tara Chase, or is she just a woman you would like to have met? I mean, on a binge, in a bar, not at the end of a barrel, or was she just someone you dreamed up?
The long and the short. The short version is that Tara is named after Tara Chase, who was a woman that I went to high school with and who I would, you know, go over to her house late at night on the weekends, and we would sit in the dark and watch spy stories as opposed to doing what everybody else was doing at that point. And boy, it took me forever to realize, oh yeah, gosh, she kind of had a thing for me, didn't she? Dying. And she is a wonderful, wonderful lady, and one of the smarter people I know, and one of these people who I actually suspect does work for the CIA, though she's doing a good job of maintaining her cover. She's got like six languages and that kind of thing.
Wow.
That's the real Tara Chase. That's where the name comes from. Now, the character comes from a different place, and it's kind of an amalgam of this woman that, you know, I guess had sort of emerged in stories that I've been working on for years. It just sort of grew out of it. She's probably, now that I think of it, she's probably the strongest influence is William Gibson's Molly from Neuromancer.
Wow.
I think there's an element there that that probably, you know, she owes a large part to that. And I think there was just a lot of it sort of came about sort of idly. You know, I would write stories and various iterations of this character would show up. And then when the time came to write Queen and Country, you know, it was the time to sort of take all those iterations and put her together into this person that I was calling Tara Chase, warts and all. You know, and I think there's a piece of Tara that certainly comes out of, you know, adolescent fantasy, you know, of the same type of adolescent fantasy that gets you Kate Beckinsale in Leather and Underworld, you know what I mean? the super lethal sexy woman,
sure.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
But I think as I got older, she became more realistic and less fetishized.
Okay.
Or at least I would hope so. Because frankly, if she's fetishized now, I need some therapy. You know, I mean, that girl's got some serious problems, and I don't find them attractive. So,
you know, I see her kind of becoming Jane Tennyson down the line.
Yeah, I think that's not a bad analog, and certainly, you know, certainly Helen Mirren is an influence. You know, certainly the Prime Suspect stuff leaks in.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be hard-pressed to, you know, actually draw a list. I kind of surprised myself there by reaching to the back of my head and pulling out the William Gibson thing. It wasn't really until talking about it that I thought of it. Normally, the iteration of that character, and you see it in, you know, in Critical Space and again in Patriot Acts, drama is another iteration of that. You know, Elena is another sort of piece of that kind of question. And I think that's another thing, is I tend to come back to the same issue over and over in my writing. I always seem to come back to nature versus nurture issues. And I do it now without even meaning to. You know, I can sit up and go, oh, wait, look what I did. I'm doing it in Checkmate with Sasha. You know, she had her nature changed by Brother Eye. So what does that make her now? But that's less intentional. With Elena, it's very clearly a character who was nurtured to be something. You know, she was nurtured to be this killer.
Mm-hmm.
And can you change it? Can you change your nurture? Can you change your nature? That tends to be the question I think I keep coming back to.
Manny Fresh. Greg, what do you consider your strengths and weaknesses as a writer? I think you have several strengths. For instance, I think you're a skilled plotter. The plots you concocted for Queen and Country and Checkmate are clever and easy to follow while remaining complex.
I'm not sure people would agree with that, but it's nice of them to say so. I think there are people out there who read Checkmate, especially that first four, and go, what? I did what? I'm not sure about strengths. I think that I'm pretty good at finding what I feel is an emotional truth in a story. And I think that's, and for me, stories live or die on that, on whether or not you can believe in the characters. And I think I'm pretty good at making the characters believable, sometimes to their detriment. I think that, for instance, Fistful of Rain suffers from Mim being a little too believable, and a lot of people found that book very difficult, if not impossible, to read because they wanted to slap her silly in that way that when you see self-destructive people self-destructing, you kind of want to go, okay, either knock it off or let me leave. But I have no urge to be in the car when you crash it. You know, my weaknesses are legion. I think, especially in comics, that I consistently do not go big enough. I am not comfortable doing large-scale epic battles, which is the stuff that, you know, comics, that's the bread and butter of the medium.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's something that there are times when I'm better at it, and there are times when I'm worse at it. You know, it's what allows me to write Gotham Central with Ed, I think, in a compelling and, again, emotionally honest fashion. And I think it's one of the things that probably hurt Wonder Woman and Superman, both of whom are really big characters who really need big battles. And there weren't that many. But I also tend to get really hung up on issues of internal logic. I want to know why. And it sometimes paralyzes me. I will sit and look at a story and know that the beat I want is an action beat. But then I have to come up with the whole reason for it. You know? And it's not simply, well, because they're robbing the bank. It has to be, okay, but why are they robbing the bank? How are they going about the robbery? When did it start? What was the, you know what I mean?
Sure.
I overanalyze something that drove Mark and Jeff nuts on 52. really did, because there would be times I'd be like, but why? And they would really, you could hear them grinding their teeth and wanting to shout, just cause! and, you know, as I've said, I think I said in that CBR interview I did with Robert Taylor, you know, Jeff has no problem with doing the cool thing because it's cool. And I have a problem with doing the cool thing just because it's cool. And there's a happy medium there, but it's far closer to what Jeff does than what I do, because that's what comics are about. And I think, you know, especially there, I'm very weak. I've been struggling with it for a while, and I think, you know, as I said, there are times when I'm better at it, and there are times when I'm worse. The Batman-Superman stuff is much bigger, because that book kind of comes with a warning label that says, you know, keep your arms inside the riot at all times. And Loeb established that from the start, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, that's just one. I can go on. Yeah, I'm, you know, another huge weakness, I'm not nearly as fast as I wish I was. I've gotten slower the older I get. I hate the fact that I try as I might, can't seem to get a novel out annually. I think that's probably been the biggest detriment to the novel writing career, is that, you know you're going to get a Clancy every year. You know you're going to get a Meltzer every two. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You got no clue when the next Kodiak novel's coming. I mean, you really don't. It's anybody's guess. You know, I don't know. What date looks good to you? Sure, stick a pin in it. And I had a conversation with my editor between the last time we spoke and, mm-hmm. and now, where I got on the phone with her and I said, okay, here are the options. I kind of laid out the board for her. I said, these are the four novels that I can potentially write next. If you pick item A, maybe I can get you a draft by the beginning of November. If you pick item B, I can definitely get the draft in by the beginning of September. Same with item C. And if you want item D, you're going to wait until summer next year.
Oh, boy.
And, you know, she laughed, and we discussed it, and we went ultimately with the one that I'm supposed to get in at the beginning of November. And she ended the conversation by saying, you'll miss the deadline, but that's okay. And I said, but I'll try. And she says, you always try, and that's why it's okay. So, you know, I'm also, this has less to do, I think, with writing itself. I have a horrible time saying no. I'm very, very bad at saying no to people when they come and say, here, would you like this? How about trying this? I'll think of the no later, but that's normally a day or two after I said, sure.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, which is a little too late. And it's gotten to the point where Jen really is like, no, you now have to run everything past me.
Wow.
So, and I don't, which, you know, infuriates her. So.
Any thoughts as we're closing in on the final month of 52? And we won't talk.
Yeah,
until
I saw the pencils. I mean, they finished week 52, and damn, it looks good.
Did it turn out the way you were hoping for, and everything?
Yeah, I think it did. Jeff and Grant and Mark did remarkable heavy lifting on the last couple of issues. There were periods where, just due to workload, some of us were carrying more than others. But they really, I think, are responsible for the success of week 52. And I do think it's successful. And there's some moments in it that I think are just wonderful, wonderful moments. just inspired, very clever pieces of writing and, you know, right down to how the page composition. I think it's going to be, I think people are going to really like this issue. You know, the hope is that when all is said and done, they're going to put it down and go, hey, the end. Cool. You know, and feel like I've read this from beginning to end, and it has a resolution, and it does what ideally a novel does at its end, which is it leaves you with some questions, and it leaves you with some closure, and hopefully it'll haunt you for a little bit. You know, I mean, to everybody who's actually made it through 52, you know, and because as much as it was a marathon for us, it was a marathon for all of you guys. You really, you have my profound thanks. I mean, thank you for bearing with us. Thank you for bearing with the stuff that you didn't like to get to the stuff that you did. And thanks for coming back each week. And thanks for you know, believing that we were going to do it. That matters a lot. Because it really was like we went out on a dare. And even if we knew sort of intellectually we're going to, you know, this is not going to fail, we're going to go all 52, there's still that hope that, well, you can go all 52 and it can still be crap, you know? and I do think at the end of the day we went all 52 and it wasn't, you know, it was good. And that's remarkable. You know, I'm grateful for everybody who came along for the ride.
You said that you love Faulkner and Hemingway.
Yeah.
Do you read any other suspense thriller spy authors? I know you do. And if so, who?
Well, you know, I read the long laundry list of the classics. Go down the line, you know. We're talking Espionage. not specifically, with Carre and Dayton and Fleming. And we can go on and on, but you know, we'll take a quick trip down to the library and look, shall
we? Ooh, I like that. That's like we're entering the Rucka Cave.
Yeah, well, it makes it seem far bigger than it is. By entering the library, I say we're going down to the basement. I read recently The Forever War, which is not a new book by any stretch.
Now, you rattled a few spy names off. Ludlum, is he in there?
No, actually, he's not, for no really good reason.
Okay.
I think I've just sort of avoided him. I just read The Blonde by Yitzhak Sneek. What's his name? I can never pronounce his name, which is going to, you know, hurt me because he's like represented by my agent. It's Dwayne Szczerniewski.
Okay.
He also wrote a book called Wheelman.
Cool.
It was his first one, and actually I was talking to my agent today, and he's got the manuscript for the new one, and he said, you know, when you're on vacation, I'll send it to you, to which I was like, oh, good.
Cool.
And his stuff is just fun, and just, you know, I mean, it's almost like punk. It's almost like modern or postmodern punk espionage. I mean, it's just great, sort of nouveau, hard-boiled. I can't find a really good, quick way to describe it. I think it's fantastic.
That's
There's
cool.
a guy I met when I was in Bristol last year named Alan Guthrie, who's got a book that I just finished, Two-Way Split, which I thought was fabulous. I have waiting in front of me to read Barry Eisler's books about his assassin, John Rain, which I met him again in Bristol last year, and he was another one of these writers where I was like, God, you know, if you write as well as I suspect you do, I'm going to read your stuff and become very depressed. Kind of I have a friend who gave me this book that just looks great, Homes on the Range. It's by Steve Hawkins Smith, and it is a mystery set in 1893 Montana with two brothers, Big Red and Old Red, who are fans of Sherlock Holmes, and they've been reading the stories as they get them. So they're using their deducifying skills. again, this friend gave me the book. I was like, you have to read it. I read Denny O'Neill's Helltown.
Me too. What'd you think? Gary, you're a Big Question fan.
I loved it.
Me too, man.
I mean, I absolutely loved it.
The changes didn't bother me at all. I thought they were interesting,
no,
and
you know,
it opened the story.
You know, Denny understands, you know, how to write both.
Sure.
And damn, he does it well. So, but I'm always going to read what Denny writes.
Are we still looking for authors? Because as we are, I'll just mention that Paper Cut says, from the conversations you've had on Word Balloon and on Around Comics, I think you and someone like Vince Flynn could have a deep and spirited conversation. And I believe Vince Flynn is the guy who does the Bullpen Bulletins podcast.
Huh. I don't know. I believe it. I'll take his word for it.
Well, I can tell you that Chris Neesman from Around Comics and I always have fun talking and swiping authors' names with Greg as well.
I think Chris was talking about, last time I talked to him, the time before, we were talking about Talik Panos as well.
Yeah, he's, oh my God.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. We could devote far too much time to this.
Okay.
I mean, I picked up Dan Simmons's, I think it's his new one, The Terror.
Who again?
Dan Simmons,
okay.
And I think Simmons is great. I mean, I still think Phases of Gravity has got to be one of my favorite novels ever. I thought it was just phenomenal. And nobody seems to know that book. They know his other ones. They know Hyperion. They know Fall of Hyperion. You know, they know Hollow Man. But most of them don't seem to know that he wrote this little book called Phases of Gravity, which is this lovely story about what it's like to have walked on the moon and then have to walk the rest of your life on Earth, really.
John wants to ask also what you think of Studio 60, since he remembers talking to you and Judd Winnick about West Wing.
I know, I'm going to get booed. I haven't seen it. You know, it's television. I don't have time to watch television. I have time to TiVo it, but I don't have time to actually watch what I TiVo. Most of the TV viewing I'm doing is now at the gym when I'm running, you know, and on the iPod. It'll be out on DVD. I'll see it then.
There you go.
Jacob Beecher asks, Greg, big fan. I seem to remember from the previous podcast how you have an office where you write. What kind of hours do you keep? Do you normally write when you're working office hours, or do you write at any odd time, like suddenly after a weird dream?
I used to be more free, you know, in the hours I could keep. I've got two kids now, and they don't care. and consequently, I write pretty much when people should be working, and then I'll write again late into the night. But I tend to be up by 7, and I tend to have my daughter out and to her school and back home by 8:30, which, you know, is 11:30 on the East Coast, so you can normally get emails from editors and put out any immediate fires. And then I will work through the day and pick up my daughter at about 4. Kids go to bed hopefully by 9:30. They're asleep, though, you know, my daughter is 3 and a half, and consequently getting her to go to sleep is its own adventure. And if I'm not too exhausted, then I'll go down to the office and I'll probably put in another 2 hours, 2 and a half hours. And that's quote unquote the regular schedule, but that can be very easily disrupted by phone calls that come through the day, you know, travel, illness, and days off. For instance, I've discovered that apparently kids these days go to school a lot less than I did when I was young. My son has had more days off from school in since January than literally there was a sequence where like every week he had a day off. And I lose those days.
Sure.
I'm starting to work out of the house a little more. I try to take one day a week to kind of get out, and I'll go to a bookstore here in Portland, and I'll sit in their coffee room. And I'll try to do my reading, any work that isn't strictly, you know, the typing phase of the writing. You know, when I was younger, the best hours to write were the dark hours. You know,
sure.
10 at night to 3 or 4 in the morning. When I was in graduate school and I was doing that, my wife was working, you know, from 8 to 5. And we weren't seeing each other. And she sort of sat me down within the first semester and said, this is going to have to change or else we're not going to be married for much longer. And I kind of went, yeah, you're right. And it's there's no reason that I can't do both. So I had to sort of teach myself how to write during the day. And it really was something I had to teach myself to do.
Do you write longhand, or do you just go right to the word process?
I've been mixing it up more. I was in a phase where everything would just be, I'd just start typing. And I was finding that harder and harder. And in the last couple of months, I've been doing a lot of work longhand, breaking comics down longhand, and sort of drawing out pages for myself, not so much to be forwarded to the artist, but to go, okay, how can I use this? And then typing that way. I've gotten slower the older I've gotten and the longer I've been doing this. And I don't know if that's because I'm just exhausted, which I am, or if it's because, you know, one hopes that as you work at your craft, you get better at the craft. And consequently, two other things enter into it, which is, well, you don't want to repeat yourself. I don't want to write the same scene, you know, in Checkmate that I wrote 6 years ago in Detective.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't, you know, in theory, I should be a better writer. I may not be, but in theory, I should be.
Or more efficient?
Well, perhaps more efficient, but also more aware of the mistakes that I've made in the past, and consequently, you know, more careful these days. I find that, for me, you know, writing is a solitary pursuit. But I find that I write better if I've had somebody that I can talk to about what it is I'm going to write. And all I really need them to do is to listen, just so I can vocalize and then work it out that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never been one of these writers who wants to go off and, you know, be locked away in their garret all alone. I want to be able to talk to my editors and, you know, talk to my peers and say, well, what would you, you know, what about this? And, you know, I find, yeah, I was wrestling with a thing for that Batman Superman story I mentioned earlier, and I had been wrestling with this problem for literally months, because I saw it coming and I couldn't figure out what I was going to do. And I called Nunzio this Sunday after having talked to like three or four other people about this and said to him, you know, this is what it is, this is what I want to accomplish. And I think he said like maybe three words, and I was like, okay, so, well, this is what I'll do, you know. And then I was like, thanks. And he was like, you know, I didn't do anything. I said, actually, you did more than you know. But I got, you know, I got off the phone and got back home, you know, from where I was out at the time that I made the call. And, you know, I wrote 8 pages.
That's cool.
Because all of a sudden, you know, that being able to throw it out there and bounce it back, I saw what I wanted to do and how to do it.
Jacob wants to know how long your DC exclusive is. He's very satisfied with your DC work, but he just wondered if, let's see, how's he saying? Are you champing at the bit to write Marvel stories, or would you enjoy freelancing?
My exclusive, I believe, is up at the end of the summer, and I'm not really making plans beyond that right now. You know, I'm not willing to go on record one way or another because I just haven't decided exactly what it is I want to do. There are things that I want to pursue, and I have to decide the best ways I'm going to be able to do that. I've been really, really fortunate in my career. I've gotten the opportunity over basically 10 years in comics to write just about every character I wanted to. And that's a really wonderful honor, you know? So I don't actually go, you know, I'm dying to write this character, I'm dying to write that character. There are really only a handful of them that I haven't had the opportunity to work with that I've really wanted to, you know.
Jacob asks, and if you can just do a quick list of some movies or TV shows or comics that are on your must-see list.
I'm very excited that the third series of Doctor Who is going to debut this Saturday, and I have absolutely enjoyed the first two series. That was one show that I actually managed to watch consistently. Jen and I, that's kind of our date show.
That's cool. you guys got it.
let's see, what else? This is probably going to be one of those.
Did you watch Life on Mars? Have you watched that show?
I have had. Wade has been trying to get me to watch it, and James Lucas Jones, you gotta watch it, you gotta watch it, you gotta watch it. And I understand they're now showing Series 2 on
BBC
America.
Neesman and I are huge fans as well.
So. Yeah, well, and I've heard nothing but good things. Actually, one of the plans there is to watch it while I'm on hiatus. So that's coming up. I have DVDs that a friend burnt for me of the first series.
Cool.
I'm intending to catch up.
Were you a Sweeney fan?
I was, yeah. And actually, I've been watching some old episodes. My agent was sending them to me. They're wonderful. And, you know, I love John Thaw.
Yeah. Inspector Morse, absolutely.
Exactly. So it's like, look, he's being young and tough.
Yeah, I had no idea. And the other guy, George, I'm loving his new show on the BBC. It's called New Tricks.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you've heard about this. Amanda Redman from Sexy Beast, who played Ray Winston's wife.
Right.
She's the lead, and she is a chief inspector, and she's in charge of three retired cops that are doing a cold case file sort of squad. Huh. And it's funny, but I think there's a decent, you know, television detective mystery each week as well.
Oh, that's cool. I'm going to have to check that out too. Thanks. Good.
Nope. Well, there you go.
Adding more stuff. Thank you.
well, this is all for the break. How long will the break be? Will you have enough time to really recharge?
I'm trying to take a month off. The goal is to go 30 days without having to do anything because somebody said I need it. Because I can't go 30 days without writing, but what I want to be able to do in that time is write some of the stuff that I've been pushing off. And also, I want to spend a couple days just reading, and I want to spend a couple days just vegging.
Sure.
There's so much stuff to catch up on. I mean, the stack of books right now is so high, I'll die before I finish it. And the same can be said for movies. The Netflix queue is embarrassingly long. You know.
Are theaters out of the question because of the kids?
Yeah, I mean, getting into a movie theater right now is a Herculean task.
Okay. So I won't ask you about The Good Shepherd, and I won't ask you about Breach.
Again, and both films that I really wanted to see, and both films that I haven't been able to.
Okay.
The last movie I think I saw in a movie theater was Night at the Museum.
Okay.
So there you go. What are we watching? Well, I'm watching Mythbusters with my son.
Very nice.
And he's seven, and I have to say it is engaging him in a way that I am delighted to see and had never considered. He grows up in a house surrounded by, you know, his mom and dad are readers and we're liberal arts majors, and, you know, we write for a living. Sciences were not too heavy on in this household. And watching this show, you can see him getting it and trying to grasp the concepts, and that's really cool. And then the only thing that I've actually been sort of catching up on, this started when I was working on Patriot X at the beginning, as I got the first series, the first season of Law and Order Criminal Intent on DVD.
Okay.
And there was a while, you know, like 10 years ago, where I was watching a lot of Law and Order. And then they started all the spin-off series.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had left the fold by then because I got kind of tired of it.
Sure.
And I also thought that it very much follows the politics of the day, whether the show admits it does or not. It really does follow. They're very good about reading, I think, mainstream America's, you know,
take.
Political take, yeah. And,
okay.
And then crafting their stories to satisfy that.
Okay.
And roughly about the time the country started going away that I really didn't like, so did the show. ironically enough. But when I was working on Patriot Act, I had this set, and I would, you know, I'd work. I was in a hotel for about a week and a half working, and then I would, you know, I'd watch an episode or two. And I loved D'Onofrio's performance, and I'm a huge Sherlock Holmes fan, you know, and Gorin is Holmes. He is, you know, Rene Balsay, and he admits it, you know, Rene Balsay is Holmes' character. And D'Onofrio's performance is fabulous, and I will watch that show just for him. And then, of course, they brought in Chris Noth. They brought Logan back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that brings me that's back in the original Law & Order days.
Right.
So I'm in familiar character territory. So I've been actually watching those. And then, again, I was watching, they released the first two seasons of Rockford Files on DVD.
Yep.
watched all those. I now have, my wife got me for my birthday, the first season of Simon and the Simon.
Wow, it's the whole Mike Post
I got
theme music, you know, repertoire.
I've got the first season of Magno as well.
There you go, another Mike Post music, and yeah, hey, Steve Cannell.
Rockford, Simon and Simon, and Magnum is all research. Can you guess what the project's going to be, guys? So,
I love Rockford, and I found Magnum late, but Simon and Simon, you're on your own on that one, man.
Yeah, well, I didn't say it was good, okay? All I can remember is the actor who played AJ. I read an interview with him when I was...
Gerald McRaney?
No,
that's the other one.
That was...
That's Rick?
That's Rick.
Okay. The blonde dude.
Yeah.
Not John Schneider.
No, and he's... going to kill me. I can't remember his name. And I remember reading this interview. You know, I was had to be very young. And they were talking about, you know, how he was the smart one. Like, he really was the smart one. He, like, had an advanced degree and so on. But I remember him saying in this interview, and I love this quote. I still use it today. There are people out there who believe that Star Trek is filmed on location. And I thought that was just brilliant. Like, you know, so, and there was actually, I remember, you know how when you're young and you're being exposed to drama,
mm-hmm,
for the first time, every time you see a new take or a new trope, it's very exciting.
Sure.
There was an episode of Simon and Simon, and this is why, you know, Jen got me this set. There was an episode, and all I don't remember the details of it. All I remember is that early in it, AJ is in a racquetball court playing racquetball with a guy, and they are attacked from the gallery by some guy with an automatic weapon. And, you know, all AJ can do is huddle in the corner as this other guy gets shot apart.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm, what, 12, 13, 14, and I'm watching this on television, and it was the first time I had ever seen somebody using a gun on TV and showing you how terrifying it was. It wasn't a cool shootout. And the whole episode, you know, in my memory, I haven't seen it since then, my memory was AJ dealing with that sense of impotence and fear and powerlessness and you know, trying to come to grips with what had happened. So you can knock Simon and Simon all you like, but they pulled that episode out.
All right, well.
You know what I mean?
And
you know, if you're willing to wade through, you'll find a diamond eventually.
All right, if you find an equally, like, Cagney and Lacey moment like that, then I'll have to wrestle you.
Yeah, I haven't gone looking yet. So. But, like I said, you know, that was a huge moment for me.
That's cool.
Because I had never seen violence portrayed that way, in the same way that in the Sandbaggers episode, Decision by Committee, when Willie and Karen are on the airplane.
That's an amazing episode, yeah.
That is an amazing episode. The very first time I saw that, and this was before MTV did everything in split-second edits, I had never seen violence done that way. It was so fast and so visceral and so terrifying. And you watch it now, and it's almost slow. But the impact when I saw it for the first time was this realization of that is violence. They made the violence literally a violent experience on the screen. It happened so fast and so chaotically that until it's over, you're not quite sure what happened. And it's not clean, and it's not pretty, and it's not this, I grab your arm, and I twist it here, and I break it here, and I throw you this way. You know, these people are fighting for their lives. And the look on Ray Lyons' face when he fires that last shot, you know, if you know the episode where the guy's got his hand, he's got a duffel bag that they think the bomb is in.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, I'll set it off, and Willie shoots. And then they hold on him, you know, when he's holding his pistol and he's clearly emptied it, but you're not sure how because, you know, the slide's locked back. He's got blood spatter on him, gunpowder burns on him,
yeah.
And, you know, this guy is the closest, you know, this guy is quote-unquote James Bond, and the look on his face is, I'm going to be seeing this guy for the rest of my life. I'm going to be living this moment for the rest of my life. And, you know, everywhere else I was looking at violence that it was, you know, where you would literally watch Magnum and it seemed every episode he would shoot somebody, you know, and it didn't matter. You know, those are formative dramatic experiences in the same way that reading Stephen Crane was formative and reading how he depicted violence. You know, I write stories that have a lot of violence in them. There's some violence in Patriot Acts, man, that, you know, you get pretty much the whole Greg Rucka sort of cafeteria tray. You get, you know, by the time you hit chapter three, there's a gunfight in chapter three that is the whole chapter, and is the kind of gunfight you would get with soldiers being smart, right? And how we're going to do this,
mm-hmm.
and here's the scenario, and then there's a sequence, you know, where you get hit with violence and you don't see it coming. You know, I mean, it comes and it's abrupt. It's literally, and in the middle of the sentence, I'm going to kill somebody. and then there's, you know, it is in its own way. I think that this book is far more an examination of violence and the impact on lives and how it begets itself, far more than I think anything I've ever written. Yeah, but I mean, you read Crane. Like, I think it's a moment of heroism as a short story. I remember having a writing instructor at Vassar who literally had me, look at this sentence and look at how, you know, he's putting the words in the wrong order to describe the cannon blast. You know, that the world has gone chaotic and sort of come apart. And that realization of, like, wow.
That's cool.
And you read that without realizing that's what you're reading, in the same way that, you know, you'll read Hemingway's, you know, Hills Like White Elephants, and your eye will go right over the sentence, on this side of the railroad tracks, ... But that this is brilliant, because where are you standing? He just put you in the story. You weren't in sentence one. You're now on this side of the railroad tracks. Not on one side or on the west side, but on this side. I dig shit like that. What do you want from me?
As we wrap up, I'll say I hope we get to talk during the summer when you are able to talk about some of the new things that have
been. That would be great.
And we can check in again on the status of Checkmate and have a more traditional conversation.
That would be great.
My best to you and Jen, man. Take care.
Have a good night.
Well, that wraps things up for the Rucka Debrief 07, but as we say, Greg and I hope to be talking later this summer when more information comes out about Greg's future projects after the summer convention season is underway. Word Balloon's brought to you by MailOrderComics.com. Today's comics at yesterday's prices. They've got new 75% discounts on your pre-ordered new releases and more 50% discounts than ever before. That, coupled with their unmatched ordering system and the best customer service to be found yet, they're going to make you glad you made the switch to Mail Order Comics for all your comic book collecting needs. Every month you'll enjoy standard discounts of 38% on large press and up to 38% on all small press publishers. They've added double the specials with discounts of 50% or more, twice as many DC, Image, and Marvel monthly specials. For all the details, go to MailOrderComics.com. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. Don't forget, Word Balloon can be found all over the place on the internet at iTunes, Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle, our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon, our ComicSpace page, comicspace.com/wordballoon, and of course our home at Newsarama. Lots of great interviews still on the way in the month of May. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2007.